From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. After 8 weeks of investigating these two crime scenes, the biggest question that we need to have answered before we can begin to piece a timeline and crime scene or scenes reconstruction together is, are these two attacks connected? Did the same offender or offenders shoot and kill Sheila Barty and Liz Ayers at the ball field on Idaho Street and then leave that scene and continue the killing spree with Anthony Jeffers, Angela, and Suzanne Wallace? Or are these two completely separate incidents that just happened to occur on the same night? By the end of today's episode, I think that we can definitively answer that question. Last week, Liz's daughter gave us a pretty big clue. These weren't five random, unconnected victims. Liz explained that not only did her mother know Anthony Jeffers, but they were friends. Close friends, in fact. Liz herself even knew him. In a city with a population of over 100,000 people at the time, two people who knew each other very well, who often spent time together, were both murdered about a mile apart within an hour of each other. That's a strong start to making a connection. But to be sure, we need to dig a little deeper. We're going to begin with the trial testimony of firearms examiner Henry Hatch. Like many of the witnesses at this trial, Hatch's testimony was pretty short and sweet. Prosecutors Susan Collins and Allison Benjamin seemed to make a habit of not pulling on any threads too hard in front of the jury. They get in, draw out the basic information that they want the jurors to hear, and get out. With a weak case like this one, particularly when they have a confession on the record that doesn't match the evidence, a prosecutor doesn't want the jury to think too hard about details. Instead, every state's witness is an opportunity to get a little bit of good evidence in an attempt to avoid questions that will reveal the bad evidence. And Hatch's testimony is no different. You would think that the bullet analysis would be a huge part of this case, and truly it makes up the overwhelming majority of the physical evidence presented at trial. The firearms examiner analyzed a total of 10 bullet fragments from both crime scenes. And yet the entirety of his testimony is captured in just 22 pages of trial transcript. And that's including direct examination, cross, redirect, and recross. Out of those 22 pages, the first 13, over half, are just a recitation of Hatch's credentials and training, as well as an explanation of how this type of analysis works. He explains what lands and grooves and striations are. And then he says in a general sense that all of the bullets from this case that had enough markings on them for comparison likely all came from the same gun. Now, before we dig into the couple of pages of testimony where we actually get some concrete, or at least meant to be concrete, data, I think it's first important to at least point out that this type of testimony probably would never happen in a courtroom in 2025. And that's because tool mark analysis and identification like this has been called into question over the years and has been shown to be extremely subjective and bordering on junk science. So here's the history of firearm tool mark analysis in the U.S. court system. For about 100 years, it was very common to have an expert on the stand testify that two bullets were fired from the same gun to the exclusion of all others. Analysts would testify in absolutes all the time. They would compare their firearm analysis to fingerprint analysis. I would say that it's just that unique. But shortly after this case went to trial, the scientific community started to question the validity of this so-called science. And in 2009, the National Academy of Sciences did a study that resulted in a pretty scathing report. The NAS report called out firearm and tool mark analysis for lacking any kind of statistical foundation. It said that examiners couldn't reliably quantify any kind of error rate in their determinations and in no uncertain terms declared that testimony claiming certainty like this was not scientifically supportable. Then, in 2016, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology did an even more in-depth study and generated their own report. They labeled firearm and tool mark analysis as a, quote, subjective method that had an insufficient foundational validity. Basically, it's hogwash. After these reports were published, most judges now limit the verbiage that tool mark examiners are allowed to use on the stand. They're prohibited from using the terms match or even that bullets were fired from the same gun. The best they can do now and still have their testimony allowed is to use terms like we heard in the Delphi case. Terms like sufficient agreement, which can be loosely translated to, I think they're pretty close. The point of explaining all of that is not to dissuade you from accepting Hatch's findings. I just want you to be informed of what we're dealing with here. And it seems that what we're dealing with is the same gun very likely being used at both crime scenes. Hatch testified that he examined 10 different projectiles. He starts out by explaining that there were two of them that he wasn't able to match to the other eight. One of them was found somewhere in the house crime scene. He's not specific about where. That piece of bullet was a .38 caliber like the others and had the same class of basic markings. Five lands and grooves and a right-hand twist. Now this has to do with the rifling inside the barrel. The barrel of most guns have a series of twisting grooves. That's what makes the bullet spin like a football when it leaves the barrel. Five lands and grooves and right-hand twist basically just tells us that the gun that fired the bullet had five rifling grooves and they twist in a right-hand direction. He doesn't say this in his testimony, but a quick bit of research will tell you that lots of .38 caliber guns from several manufacturers have these same basic specs. So it really doesn't tell us much. One bullet can be fired from a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum and another from a Taurus 38 Special, and they would both have these same basic marks. Five lands and grooves and a right-hand twist. What Hatch needs to really make a claim of being fired from the same gun are unique striations on the bullet. Microscopic scratches on the copper created from tiny imperfections in the barrel. And in this case, States Exhibit 111, a partial projectile from the house, he said that there weren't enough unique characteristics to make a determination on that one way or the other. And the same is true of a bullet recovered from inside Suzanne Wallace's body. This one only had two lands and grooves visible because the bullet was so mutilated. And on that topic, there's something that really needs to be made clear here. So Hatch's testimony gives the impression that these are all bullets, all 10 of them. But in reality, in a lot of the exhibits he's talking about, it's just a small piece of a bullet. In one case, a bullet had broken up into 14 pieces inside the skull of one of the victims. He was able to identify tool marks on one of the 14. But the more important part for us is to understand that there weren't 14 bullets inside their head. There was one bullet broken up into 14 pieces. Similarly, there were several tiny pieces of lead found on the floor at the house crime scene. Most of them probably came from the same bullet as it broke apart. In fact, that's one of the things I'm still confused about in Hatch's testimony. There are definitely some gaps and some inconsistencies. State's Exhibit 112 is a perfect example. That item is brought into evidence during crime scene tech Bertosi's testimony that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. In his testimony, he describes it as a lead fragment recovered from the living room floor. It's basically useless. You don't get striations or groove marks on the lead core of a bullet. You get those marks from the copper jacket. But in Hatch's testimony, he says that Exhibit 112 is a bullet projectile recovered from the coroner's office. He says that it was a bullet from inside of Suzanne Wallace's head. He also says that it's one of the eight bullets that he was able to identify as being shot from the same gun. So your guess is as good as mine as to how you can start with a lead fragment from the floor and end up with a copper jacket from inside someone's head. Regardless of all the confusion and inconsistencies, Hatch's testimony in and of itself was pretty cut and dry. He believes that the bullets were all fired from a revolver and that 8 of those bullets were all fired from the same gun. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. So Hatch testified that 8 of these bullets were all shown to be fired from the same gun. Here's a list of the bullets and where they were recovered from. 1 was recovered from inside Amp's body, 1 from inside Angela's body, 1 from Susan's body, although that's the one I just mentioned that may have come from the floor. 3 of the bullets came from the floor of the house crime scene. 1 came from inside of Sheila's head from the ball field. And the last one was found in the snow near a coat that was near the bodies at the ball field. That one would have had to have been from Liz's head wound. So there's a lot of wiggle room here and certainly not enough information to narrow down exactly how many shots were fired. Even if Hatch's conclusions are 100% accurate, we still have 2 rounds from the house that couldn't be matched, and we have the unrecovered bullet that passed through Liz's chest. But we do know this, again, assuming Hatch's conclusions are accurate. There were 2 bullets fired at the ball field and 6 bullets fired at the house that all came from the same gun. All right, as we move on, I'm going to tell you right now, this is probably the shortest episode that we've ever produced. I set out this week to look through the case file to find out one way or the other if these 2 crime scenes were connected. Hatch's testimony all but proved that they are. But there is one more connection that we need to address. So Tasha told us last week that her mother knew Amp Jeffers. Aside from what she told us, we have one more witness from trial that's going to help us solidify that connection. And take it from 2 people who knew each other to 2 people who were together on the night they were both killed. That witness is Willie Marshall, Amp's brother. We heard way back in episode 1 that 12-year-old Larry had testified that Amp had called Willie that night and told him about the men who had come to the house. The first visit to the house, not the final fatal visit. At trial, Larry's testimony was all about pointing the finger at Chris. But in Willie's testimony, we get a little bit more information. Now, I'm going to tell you up front that most of what Willie testifies about is provably false, at least in regards to what Chris Bynum was doing that night. Regardless, this is what Willie told the jury. He said that Amp had called him that night between 1 and 1:20 a.m. and told him that a guy named Chris had just come to the house and pointed a gun at him, threatening him. This would be the phone call that Larry said he overheard. Willie goes on to say that he knew that his brother was talking about Chris Bynum because Chris Bynum had come to his girlfriend's house earlier that day and threatened his brother. And according to Willie, Chris wasn't alone. From the transcript, quote, "How did you know that this is the Chris that your brother was talking about? Because, okay, what triggered off earlier that day, he had came by my girlfriend's house in Lake Station with Liz Daly. Who is he? Chris came by my girlfriend's house with Liz Daly earlier that day, and he was threatening my brother." End quote. Now, there are all kinds of problems with this. Remember, we heard last week that Liz was home with her son AJ until the evening when it got dark. That's when Tasha went to pick up her brother. Now, we're going to get into it later, but for now, just know that there's no question at all as to where Chris Bynum was that evening. He was not driving around with Liz Ayers. Like I said, that part of the story is provably false. But still, Willie, Amp's brother, has brought Liz into the picture on the night in question. During cross-examination, Chris's attorney confronts Willie with his original police statement and points out a glaring discrepancy. In front of the jury, Willie said that Chris came by with Liz on the day of the murders and threatened his brother. But in his original police statement, he told police that this trip had happened days earlier. This, of course, led me to read Willie's original statement. Listen to what he told police just a few hours after the murders. Quote, "He called me and told me that Chris had come over to his house waving a gun with a hammer back. He said that this girl named Elizabeth Daly had said something about him. She said something to Chris that caused him to come over, and I could hear Anthony's girlfriend in the background saying that I'm going to kick that bitch's ass if she comes back over here. I saw Chris a couple of days ago, and he was threatening my brother about something Liz said." End quote. In this version, Willie goes on to say later in the statement that he doesn't know Chris. He's just seen him around the neighborhood. Chris Bynum didn't live anywhere near that neighborhood, by the way. But in any case, the part of the statement that got my attention was that whoever this Chris was, if there really was a Chris, according to Willie, had come by the house with Liz earlier in the night, before the murders, and she was obviously still alive when they left. The part of the statement that sticks out to me is that Willie says he overheard Suzanne in the background threatening to kick Liz's ass if she came back there. That seems like an odd detail to make up. It's not about Chris. It doesn't do anything to incriminate him if the police were, in fact, feeding information to witnesses to try to build a case against Chris Bynum. It's just random. And it also fits perfectly into the hypothesis that I presented a few weeks ago. Why would someone kill Liz and Sheila at the ballpark and then drive over to Suzanne's house and kill three more people there? The only thing that made sense to me, the only reason that still makes sense to me, is that the killers knew that the people in that house had seen them leave with Liz and Sheila before they killed them, and they had to eliminate the witnesses. At the end of the day, if I had more information to share with you about a connection between these two scenes, I would share it. But this is it. And as far as I'm concerned, it's enough. We have Tasha telling us that Amp and Liz were good friends. We have the firearms examiner telling us that the bullets from both scenes came from the same gun. And we have Willie telling us that Liz had been at Amp's house that night. We went into this investigation without any preconceived notions and without making any assumptions. I wasn't prepared to just assume that the two scenes were connected. We needed to find out for ourselves. But now, after examining the evidence, I'm convinced that they were. Fortunately, this is a good week for a short episode, since it's a holiday here in America. One of the last long weekends before the kids start to get really busy at school. And we've accomplished what we set out to do. We answered one of the big questions in this case. So, now I encourage you to go do what I'm going to do. Take out the AirPods and go spend some quality time with your family. We're going to be recording this week's follow-up live on YouTube on Wednesday evening, as always. And in our next episode, we're going to fully examine one of the other big mysteries in this case. The evolution of the statements made by Larry Brooks. from his first encounter with police all the way to his deposition taken years after the trial. That's next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.